Hi, this is Derek Jensen for the Progressive Radio Network, Resistance Radio. And today I'll be talking with Four Arrows, or Don Trent Jacobs, who's a university professor, writer, and activist for American Indian rights. He's the author of more than 20 books, and today we will be discussing his book, Teaching Truly, A Curriculum to Indigenize Mainstream Education. So first, thank you for being here, Don.
It's my pleasure, Derek.
And now, the way I'd like to start off is I'd like to ask you three questions at once, and then you just take your time to answer all those questions, and then if we have time, we'll go on from there. You ready for the questions?
Sounds good.
Okay, so the first question is, what do you mean by indigenous, both generically and as it specifically applies to education? And then that leads to the second question, which is, what do you mean by indigenous education, and how does indigenous education contrast with more Western notions of education? And third, why do we care? I mean, why is all this important to individual students, to human societies, by which I mean the indigenous societies and also the dominant Western culture, and also why is this important to the planet?
Well, those are great questions because they cut to the chase, really. I mean, you hear a lot about indigenizing things. You hear a lot of scholars that are talking about returning to indigenous values. But if we don't get to the core of what we're talking about and what we mean by that, then it probably doesn't accomplish the goal very well. So, you know, talking about defining indigenous, though, it's complicated, of course. There's not a consensus. There's a lot of definitions. And I'm glad you asked it. Like, what do I mean by it? So I can. That's the only thing I have expertise in, is what I have to do with my thinking. You know, certainly there are legal definitions, but like the late great Vine Deloria said in one of my books, that law is really just conquest and masquerade. So I don't really put a lot of stock in the legal definitions, blood quantum and that sort of thing. United Nations has never pinned down a definition, you know, but they and other international organizations like the World Bank, they have an operational definition that probably relates mostly to historical continuity with, you know, before settlers came or pre-colonial. That's a common denominator, and it's indigenous people themselves, you know, have their own ways of defining it, and oftentimes it relates to staying in tune with traditions and with realizing a history of genocide, really. I have a definition that I just invented for this particular interview with you, Derek, because I had noted that on the internet this morning, I had looked up a radio station, and I saw you were quoted in an interview not too long ago, where you said that I scribbled it down here. The principal difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerner generally views listening to the natural world as a metaphor. And that brought something to my mind, because I remember a while back when I was playing the psychology game, that in the diagnostic and statistical manual that the psychologists use for defining a disorder, they used an example of somebody talking to a rock as atypical behavior, but then it said in there that's not a problem, really. It's not a pathology. It's just atypical behavior if somebody's talking to a rock. But then it went on to say, however, if they believe the rock is talking back to them, then it becomes maladaptive. So based on your quote and the DSM quote, I guess I could say a new definition for indigenous is being crazy. And but that's not so far from the reality. The reality of what we are doing in the Western worldview is seen by many as being crazy. And so if an indigenous worldview is seen as crazy by the Western worldview, it would probably mean that it's sane. One of the definitions that I wrote a long time ago in a piece for the University of Arizona called On Being Indian was a quote by Scott Mamaday. And, you know, it's kind of vague, but I always liked it. He says that an indigenous person is somebody who thinks of themselves as being indigenous. Now, you got to be careful with that because, you know, we've got a lot of new age kinds of phenomenon happening. We've got the wannabe phenomenon. It's good, bad, and its ugly sides. We've got lots of different motivations for claiming indigeneity. But, you know, when he wrote that, an Indian, someone who really thinks of themselves as being Indian, he meant it in a deeper way. It's not an easy thing to do. And you have to earn the entitlement of that claim. And so, you know, I think having the consideration of a number of factors like things that we can talk about as we roll over into talking about what is indigenous education, why is it important. I think those things that we'll talk about can really, and you know, I always get in trouble because this is a controversial idea even in Indian country, that there are some full-blooded brothers and sisters that I have that I really don't consider being Indian. And there are some people who have no known blood of indigenous ancestry that they know of. You know, in all of us are indigenous. We go back far enough, of course, but who I think are very Indian, and so I kind of like Scott Mamaday's idea that, and it's really, you know, even my own in my own Cherokee, you know, my situation is kind of strange because my mother was Cherokee Irish, but my spiritual path is Lakota because I was adopted by the Lakota and lived and worked in Sundance with the Lakota. But Wilma Mankiller, who was, you know, a Cherokee chief up until around 1995, you know, she also said, you know, an Indian is an Indian regardless of the degree of Indian blood that they possess or don't possess. So I think that, you know, there are some things that hold true that we need to realize, and that has to do with the extent that somebody is really grounded in the culture and that identifies with the culture. Of course, there's validity in genealogy, but also most Indian tribes, when you're adopted, you're as strong of a relative as if you had blood. Your own concept of being an Indian, but a worldview and the experience are crucial. And, you know, I sort of have a joke about the Lone Ranger and Tonto that talks about what's the essence of that worldview. And, you know, the Lone Ranger wants to, comes up to Tonto and says, look, I really want to learn what you know. I know on the TV program, I'm always the guy that knows everything, but I know your wisdom. So can you teach me what you know about being indigenous? And Tonto says, sure, and takes him out into the prairie, and they put up a tent, and they go in the tent, and they go to sleep, and they stake their horses out, and 3 in the morning, Tonto wakes the Lone Ranger up, and Lone Ranger thinks, oh, the test has begun, he's not going to wait till morning, this must be the Indian way, and Tonto says, what do you see? Look up and tell me what you see, and the Lone Ranger starts to think, you know, okay, I got to do this right, so he says, well, I can tell by the stars that it's going to be a nice day tomorrow, and Tonto says, yeah, but what's more important than that? Lone Ranger says, well, I can tell from the constellations that we're in the Western Hemisphere. Tonto says, yeah, yeah, but more important. So Lone Ranger keeps going with this, and he talks about the philosophy of how small we are in contrast to the planets and all that. And finally, Lone Ranger says, look, somebody stole our goddamn tent. And the idea of that joke is that the real essence of being indigenous, I believe, is being grounded in reality. So if we expect a rock to talk back to us, which we do, not all rocks, you know, some rocks won't, some can't, but many can. And, you know, I used to tell folks when I used to do some speeches in different places, different countries, I'd say, go out and touch a tree and come back. And they would all go out and touch a tree and come back. And then I would say, now, this time I want you to go out, but before you touch the tree, I want you to sincerely ask permission of the tree. And, of course, everybody would laugh, and, you know, there'd be a lot of humming and joking and stuff like that. But when they would come back in, it was profound silence. And then I'd have a translator, you know, ask what they thought. And people had, you know, profound experiences as a result of that. And so I think this idea of being indigenous is complicated, but it relates to a nature-based reality. And that is so very different in so many ways than the dominant cultural one, from a lack of the anthropocentrism to a sense of purpose that relates more to community, or a balance between community and self. So anyway, that'd be my, that's sort of the best off the top of my head overview of a definition.
I remember about 15, gosh, probably about 15 years ago, I interviewed Vine Deloria, and or maybe 10 years ago, and one of the things he was saying to me was that for him having to do with indigeneity did not have to do with taking a walk through a forest. And I remember that he said that taking a walk through a forest or taking a hike is an aesthetic experience, and he stressed the importance. And I'm saying this in terms of validating what you're saying, that he stressed the importance not of simply taking a walk for an aesthetic experience, but instead having a long-term relationship with a piece of land. That, I mean, that's how you get to know any human, is by living, is by knowing this human for many, many years, decades even. And he was saying the same thing about the land, that over time you will get to know. That it's over time how you develop character is what he was talking about.
Well, let's take that idea, and maybe we can weave that into how that relates to changing education or complementing Western education. But when Vine talks about this deep, respectful relationship with the land, with the place, and Danny Wildcat wrote a book called Power and Place, in which he talks a lot about that as well. Let me give you an example. There's a scholar from the University of Victoria named Nancy Turner who has written all about, I can't remember what it's called exactly. I think it's Sinology or something like that. But she's looked at the peoples of the Pacific Northwest and how they knew the land so well that, it blew my mind when I looked at the list. Some of the things I remember, this was up in British Columbia, because we have our summer home up on Vancouver Island. But the tribes knew, for example, that if the gooseberries start to pop out on the plant, they knew that was the time that the salmon would start running. I mean, how did they know that? Without this intimate relationship you're talking about and Vine talked about. They knew that if a wild rose, when the first wild rose blooms, that they can get the grass, the bare grasses that are used to make baskets, that they're ready. They'll be strong and flexible enough to start making the baskets with. They knew that stinging nettles, the coastal people, if stinging nettles, there was a relationship between them and when to harvest seaweeds. They knew if the pine needles turned yellow, that's when the she black bears entered the dens. I mean, on and on and on, and there's hundreds of things like that. And you just can't have that kind of knowledge for what is ultimately survival, and thrival. If what we know about all of the logbooks from the Jesuits and the Spanish conquerors and explorers of their first sightings of indigenous people, and this is without, you know, romanticizing or being Rousseauian in this, but they all talked about their happiness, their generosity, their healthy bodies, their peacefulness. And that relationship between them, because they are of the earth, I think comes from what Vine told you.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that, as I was thinking about how you know those relationships, I mean, how they knew those relationships and how you mentioned them, that I'm thinking a couple things. One is that frogs here have been on a decline as they're on declines many, many places. And it used to be 10 years ago that you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night in the spring because the frogs are so loud. And even now, 10 years later, it's much, much quieter. And I was mentioning this to a local person who I said, have you noticed this? He lives in the same forest, not very far from here. I said, have you noticed this? And he said, no, I had no idea. And the only way you could not notice is because he's been inside. You know, he hasn't actually been outside at all. And I guarantee that if the San Francisco 49ers disappeared, you know, he would know. And we do know relationships. It's just we know the relationships, but, you know, what is supposed to happen on a 2-1 count with a runner on first, you know, when you're down by one run. You know, they might put on the hit and run. My point is, yeah, there's really magical cosmic stuff going on, but there's also, what we pay attention to is what we know. And, you know, in this culture, we end up knowing a lot of things that don't have anything to do either with direct survival or with the land where we live. I mean, it's crazy, but I can name, you know, if you start doing some, okay, if somebody were to say, I'm loving it, then we probably know that's a McDonald's commercial. Or if they, you know, any sort of phrases like that, or we could do jingles or whatever. But on the other hand, I'm looking out the window, and I can't tell you. I can tell you that's a redwood. I can tell you that's a western red cedar. But what type of willow is that? You know, I have no idea. And I can name more corporate jingles. I can identify those by sound much more than I can identify bird songs by sound. I can probably identify three birds by sound is all.
And that's what I meant with the Tonto and the Lone Ranger joke. It's about priorities. It's about you didn't even notice that someone stole our tent, or you wouldn't be able to see the stars in the first place. And yet you're going into all of these other things that you've been taught are important. It's sort of being grounded in a reality of things that are really, really, truly important, like the relationships that I mentioned from the Pacific Northwest, and the listening and the hearing of frogs. I believe that this idea of anthropocentrism or human centeredness is really at the root of this. I recently invited renowned professor, Dr. Walter Block from Loyola University, because everything he had ever written I disagreed with. So I called him up and I said, look, why don't we co-author a book and we'll cooperatively argue that we must, you know, we're two professors, let's see if we can find some common ground. So we wrote a book, and it's called Differing Worldviews, Two Disagreeing Scholars Argue Cooperatively. And we did find some common ground. Alice Walker, I gave her a copy of the book thinking that she would be proud of me, you know. Yeah, but she said, you're in bed with the devil, and threw the book in the corner. But the point of what I'm making is this, that he believes that all things on Earth, rocks, trees, rivers, animals, are utilitarian for the sake of human beings. And so I'm going to know more about the baseball scores and more about the corporate jingles, because those are all utilitarian to make my life more convenient or more fun, etc. So I think that this human centeredness is, you know, Sam Keen, many years ago from my book Primal Awareness, wrote a little thing on it. He said, this is really about the story of God moving indoors. And I love that idea of God moving indoors. So our religions, our dominant religions, you know, the Abrahamic religions, our consumerism, our values, all have taken and put us on this pedestal of sorts. And once you are superior to a frog, I believe that sets the stage for a sense of superiority to, you know, people of different color, people of different persuasions, etc., etc. And I think if there's a real hallmark in understanding this idea of place-based power, of nature-based power, it really does come from that sense of relationship with the animals. mythology comes to my mind as something that is really important, and that is you know, like Mircea Eliade, and people who have talked about mythology say it's as truthful as anything that we ever could imagine when we understand the sacredness of it. Well, the mythologies of the West have twin hero stories, in which one twin is like Hercules, is like the and is an analogy, according to Carl Jung, to the sun. So they're very direct, very strong, very aggressive, very powerful. The twin, in his case, is Iphicles, somebody we have hardly ever heard of. And Iphicles is equally powerful, but more reflective, more lunar, more like the water. Well, I studied a lot of these, and there's many Greek ones, Romulus and Remus, Cain and Abel, etc., where the solar twin, like Romulus, kills the lunar twin. And I think that has informed Western culture, because I see the lunar and the solar, you know, as necessary complementarities, and lunar being about the water and the cycles being about, you know, the earth. And yet, if you look at indigenous mythologies, like the Navajo story where the two come to the father, where you have Monster Slayer, the solar twin, and child born of the water, the lunar twin. You know, when they go to fight the monsters, you know, the little brother will say, brother, I don't think you should shoot that monster with your arrow. And the big brother will say, why? And the child born of the water says, well, I think we should sing to him. I think that will work better. Well, they sing to him then. You know, they have that complementarity. But that isn't even the thing that is the most unique between the mythologies. What's the most unique is, in every indigenous twin hero mythology, every act is precipitated or enhanced by an animal or an insect or a bird or a reptile. And you just don't find that in the Greco-Roman ones. So I think your frog metaphor is an important one.
Well, I love everything you're saying. I want to say two things. I love everything you're saying. And what you said about God coming indoors, I really like that. It reminds me of something. I'd forgotten about this. This was, gosh, 25 years ago, I lived in North Idaho, which is gorgeous, and a friend was visiting, and we were driving around the backwoods and came across this very small church that was being built. And my friend said, why would you build a church in this beautiful forest when you've already got, you know, when you've already got the divine everywhere? And that has always, that really struck me quite strong back then. And the second thing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I like that.
And the second thing is, so I love everything you're saying, and now can you tie this back to, we haven't gotten to question two yet, really, about what is indigenous education, and can you tie this to indigenous education? I know that's what we've been talking about, but can you do it directly?
Yeah, to get it more specific, and that was really tricky. I mean, teaching truly the book you just mentioned, it's really the publishers on the back surprised me when they said this is a first in educational publishing, and I was a little embarrassed by that, because I know, you know, a lot of my friends have talked about trying to bring indigenous values into, but really it's true. Most all books on indigenous education are efforts to try to use indigenous values to teach Indian people. For example, I was a teacher educator at the at Northern Arizona University, and every October 14th, I had a lot of Hopi, a lot of Apache, and a lot of Navajo students in my classes. And every October 14th, I would give an assignment to get primary source resources about Columbus, from Columbus's logbooks, from his captains, from the Jesuits like Bartolomé Diaz, who were with him, and gave certain pages for them to look up. Well, of course, they wound up reading from these primary sources about cutting the hands off of people who didn't bring enough gold, about raping 14-year-old girls and laughing about it, about talking about how beautiful and generous and the people are to a fault, won't they make great slaves, that kind of stuff. And I'll never forget, I was there for a number of years after I left the Pine Ridge Reservation, and the people would come up to me and I'm talking about these are students who will be teachers next semester. They're seniors in college, born, raised on the reservations that around Arizona. They would either come up crying or in deep confusion, because in all of their educational careers, 90% of them had never heard anything negative about Columbus. They had totally bitten into the hook, line, and sinker of "He Sailed the Ocean Blue." To me, that was a staggering reality. But on the reservations, the school is a state curriculum. And so I'm talking about bringing indigenous values now, not only to indigenous peoples, but I think we're all in the same boat, and that there are these indigenous values that even many, many, many of our indigenous people are losing. And that's a tragedy. But there still are pockets of people on each of the reservations who have managed to hold on in spite of the overwhelming atrocities and loss of identity and alcoholism, etc. And they're holding on to this wisdom. And if we don't start sharing it with everybody, then not only are they going to go down, but we're going to go down too. So really what I tried to do in the book is I tried to look at what are the courses that are mainstream courses, how are they taught, what is the hegemonic influence on, you know, the corporate influence, if you will, on the curriculum. So, for example, if in health education, the curriculum, if you look at it carefully, it's almost all about making people dependent upon the healthcare system. And then I went and showed, well, what's happening in the real world about how healthy are we? You know, are we really, is the ideals of the well-intended educators being realized? And, of course, it turns out in most cases, whether it be mathematics or geography or health education or music, it's not so good. And then I went, well, if an indigenous person was going to teach or, you know, this course and, you know, not throw out the whole thing, so, you know, they get fired or whatever, but complement the standards, no matter how bad they are, what could they do if they were going to teach a course independently, which probably wouldn't happen? And that's when I try to bring in the kinds of values that we've been talking about. And so if let's say that, you know, there's a number of principles, you know, so there's seven principles that I like to talk about. Number one, life and acceptance of its mysteries is what defines what someone would refer to as indigenous religion, because we really don't think of indigenous spirituality as being religion. Well, how does that play out in school? Well, you would have a teacher that says, okay, how do I give significance and respect for relationships that exist between all things, even if we don't fully understand them? And how can we reflect on the reality of real life consequences, and the reality and the consequences of beliefs that we have? How do we distinguish between sacred stories and teaching stories? How do we, you know, how can I teach this course and bring that into play? And so we can, if you want, I can go through some other, refer to as spiritual principles of indigeneity and how to bring those into education. But, you know, just to start with, in general, I think it's taking these values and weaving them into curriculum. Just another example that just came off the top of my head was, I wrote a book called Teaching Virtues many years ago. And what I did was I took all the elementary courses, kind of similar like I do in teaching truly. But what I did is I said, look, an indigenous person wouldn't teach a skill like, let's say, in pre-contact days, making a bow and arrow as the main reason for the teaching. The main reason would be some virtue. Maybe it would be generosity. Maybe it would be humility. Maybe it would be courage. And so that's the most important thing to teach. Now, then you say, okay, now I'm going to teach you the finesse of when to cut the wood and how to curve it and what kind of strength you need for the vine, for the string. And all of that I'm going to teach you, but constantly you're going to be reminded that the whole point of this bow and arrow is so that you can respectfully accept the gift of the deer, and that you can then give that gift to the people. And so what my daughter and I, who co-wrote it with me, we actually, you know, we looked at the course standards and what they were doing, and we took them and said, okay, let's choose a virtue that kind of fits with this, and let's make the virtue the main thing, you know, whether it be honesty or fortitude or patience or you know, all these ones that is sort of universally understood as virtues. And then let's show how you can then go into the standards of teaching, you know, whatever the standards say you're supposed to teach, by comparing and contrasting and weaving in the relationship between that content and the virtue. And we did no more than that in education. I think the transformation would be phenomenal.
So one of the ways I learn best is by specific examples. So can you either use, and I don't care if you use history or mathematics or making a bow, but let's take a virtue, and I don't care what the virtue is, whether it's generosity or patience. And once again, I don't care if it's square roots or history or auto mechanics or making a bow. Can you show me?
Well, just for the fun of it, why don't you choose a virtue and you choose a course, and let's play with it.
Okay. How about? Oh, you give me a letter. I'll go a virtue with the letter.
C.
C. Is constancy a virtue? How about cooperation? Cooperation is too easy. We'll skip that one.
Probably the preeminent virtues in indigenous cultures is generosity.
Okay, let's take generosity.
In fact, the Lakota taught me something many, many years ago in preparation for a Sundance that I've written about, or you know, throw into something all the time. So I might as well throw it in here. They say that the highest expression of courage is generosity. The highest expression of courage is generosity. And, you know, and the examples of that are quite remarkable. You know, I've seen little children who are in love with a pet, say it's a little pet dog. They just absolutely are, you know, mesmerized, and it's their companion and their friend. And somebody nearby is in a situation, maybe they've lost a loved one and don't have a pet. And so, you know, the mother or father or grandfather says, you know, little star, I think they would really, really benefit from having your puppy before he becomes too bonded to you. So the little one learns to give away that puppy. Well, that takes courage.
Right.
Ella Doloria, Vine Doloria's grandmother, tells a story of two teenagers who were fighting, and one killed the other in the fight, in the intensity and passion of the fight. And the people all gathered, and this is in the 1800s, to decide, you know, what to do. Well, what they decided was, after much deliberation and the young man, you know, being put away waiting for his fate, was that the parents who lost the boy would adopt the murderer to be their new son, because that's what they had lost, was a son. Well, in the Lakota tradition, you know, making a relative, adopting a son, is a very sacred thing and requires gift giving. So the boy comes out, you know, not knowing whether he's going to be banned or maybe even killed or whatever, and he's made into a new son and given gifts. That's hard for. I share that story with a lot of non-Indian people, and boy, they're usually taken aback by it, you know. And so if we take generosity and the association it has with courage, you know, the thing that I thought would be like the least applicable was in both books was mathematics.
That's right.
Because, you know, I grew up in the Western world. quite predominantly, and you know, it'd be easy to do with history, it'd be easy to do with language, it'd be easy to do with even economics, but mathematics, you know, how can you bring you know, these things like patience and courage and generosity and fortitude, and make those the most important? Well, you know, my daughter came upon an author who was writing a book called Mathematics to Save the World, in which she was looking at all of the ways that word problems could be used to focus on relationships in nature, everything from the statistics about extinction rates to ways that creatures procreate. And looking at the relationships in that, and then looking at, without, you know, and this is probably doing a little anthropomorphizing with regards to giving human traits, but she would look at these things that were the virtues that she was talking about. She would ask, what did you learn from that assignment about patience? And, you know, first the students would only talk at the superficial level. Well, I had to have a lot of patience because I couldn't figure out the problem, you know, that kind of a thing. But she would kept going deeper and deeper until it got into relations. And I'll never forget this very specific example, because we were now implementing this on some of the reservation schools. And there was a second grade class, and the teacher was teaching, what do you have when you add 1 plus 1 plus 1? And she put these three, you know, 1 plus 1 plus 1 on the board. And nobody raised their hand, and they were kind of shy. And, you know, she was a Nebraska teacher, not Indian teacher. You know, the same teacher that taught that the first Americans were Davy Crockett and Kit Carson in a previous class. And to these Lakota children. But one little girl raised her hand. And I knew the little girl because I had been giving her music lessons on a piano. And she raised her hand, and she says, so what do you get when you get 1 plus 1 plus 1? And the little girl said, a chord. And I got it right away, you know, and I think I would have anyway, but I got it because, you know, I had taught her just simple three-note chords, you know, C, E, G on a piano is a chord, and F, A, C is a chord, right? And that was, she was so excited about learning how to play a chord and hearing the harmony of the notes, right? And so, you know, the teacher said she was wrong, of course. But if it would have been done right, if this teacher had been trained to understand the idea of sacred relationships, and she could look that math has sacred relationships all over the place. And these are known oftentimes by the children, and it doesn't have to be taught by the teacher. And in this case, the student was teaching the teacher. And she was saying, well, you know, mathematics can be harmony. It can be beauty. And, of course, you know, we could go on and do a whole hour on mathematics because of what I've learned about sacred numbers and all that in the writing of the book. But so I think there is a commonsensical piece to it. But it also requires sort of an out of the box thinking that we don't have, and part of that out of the box thinking is to be countercultural, which kind of takes us in a full circle back to definitions on indigenous, because many of the definitions really do talk about, you know, indigenous means that you are challenging and conscious and critical of the cultural genocide. And I just give you an example that happened today. I have a bunch of university students, and they're taking a course on critical reading with me. And so the first assignment I gave them was this. I said, I want you to just, in one paragraph, tell me how Helen Keller is taught in K-12 schools, how that is a classic example of educational hegemony. Now, I knew most of the students, these are all doctoral students, but I knew even they would not really know what hegemony is. It's a very complicated word, or it's, you know, usually just relates to international affairs. But nobody got it right, Derek. Nobody got it right. And it's because they didn't know really where to start with this idea of not knowing what they don't know. So I would tell them, I say, well, look, why don't you just put in Hegemony and Helen Keller and see what you get, you know? And you'll find some things. And then once you learn what hegemony is, that it's about how the ruling elite uses media and folklore and education especially to get us to believe that what is good for them is also good for us, even though it isn't. Find a definition that kind of says that. Then you could put in, well, how is the teaching of Helen Keller wrong? Anyway, you know, eventually they found out, you know, that Helen Keller is continually taught even today in a brand new McGraw-Hill book that just came out as only an inspiration for overcoming your adversity. You know, that she was blind and deaf and she was a courageous person. None of them still teach the vital things about her life, that she was a member of the Socialist Party, that she was critical of representative democracy, that she was a member of the IWW, the Wobblies, the most radical labor union in the world, because she had visited sweatshops, she had seen the pitfalls that, you know, that happened in the union busting and that kind of stuff. She filled Carnegie Hall up to speak against World War I. She was an anti-war activist. Even then, when they got that, they still didn't know why that was hegemony. How does that benefit the ruling elite? And these are doctoral students, God bless them. And so I'm not saying that it's going to be a cakewalk for teachers to be able to take these values and start to make them learn, but I think I've given guidelines to get them started at least.
Okay, well, this has all been fantastic, and we're running out of time. We have probably 2 or 3 minutes left, and I guess in the 2 or 3 minutes, could you talk about that question number 3, which is, so why is this all important who cares? You know, who cares that Helen Keller is taught wrong, or that we are taught that rocks can't talk to us, and the DSM-4 says we're crazy if we think they can, or if we don't. We don't hear the frogs, but we do know that the San Francisco 49ers have whatever record they have. Why should this change? Why is this important? Why is it important to indigenize education?
It's a beautiful ending question for only having 2 minutes, because it could really only take a couple of seconds to answer it, because our ship is sinking. Because we are truly at a tipping point, and we all are in the same boat. Every life system, as you know better than most, is at a tipping point. And even the astronaut Edgar Mitchell recently wrote that only a handful of visionaries recognize that in the indigenous worldview is our salvation for loss of sustainability. You know, and when he looked back on the Earth and from the Apollo spaceship and had his epiphany, he went into thinking this way and has come to that conclusion, as have, you know, many other great thinkers like yourself. And I just think that it's not romanticizing anybody. It's all of us have indigenous roots. It's going back to people who, when they stayed in one place long enough to figure out how things work, long enough to see that that nature was about mutual aid, not about dog eat dog, long enough to understand the beauty before us, behind us, above us, around us, long enough to see language as being in motion and diversity as being a wonder. You know, and those kinds of things are all a legacy for all of us. And yet, if you look at what's happening with the Cree and the tar sands right now, you know, they're dying at cancer rates unprecedented. We've got 60 times the tuberculosis and 4 times the diabetes on my own reservation, on and on. We are killing the source of the wisdom that we have access to. And if we don't start using that wisdom, not only for all of us, but also to give back to the people, to recognize them, to bring them in as teachers, then our seventh generation, maybe not even our fifth generation, will have had the gift that I think they should have had.
Well, thank you so much. And this is Derek Jensen with Resistance Radio for the Progressive Radio Network, and this has been Four Arrows, Don Trent Jacobs. And read his books. They're very, very good. And thank you so much for being on the show.